The Taliban are now in effective control of billions of dollars in U.S. weaponry, from thousands of grenades and machine guns to Black Hawk helicopters. American forces poured into Afghanistan over the past two decades. The equipment amassment follows months of surrenders by U.S.-backed Afghan security forces that failed to defend district centers. The Associated Press reported. AP said bigger gains followed, including combat aircraft, when the Taliban rolled up provincial capitals and military bases with a stunning speed, topped by capturing the biggest prize, Kabul, over the weekend. Over the past 20 years of U.S. spending over $83 billion in weaponry and equipment for Afghan security forces, whose collapse was years in the making, as the Washington Post headline put it. As the Taliban gained further control over territory this summer, the group showed off the weapons they gained from government-backed forces who surrendered. And this week, reported Agence France-Presse, the Taliban social media is awash with videos of Taliban fighters seizing weapons, cash, the majority supplied by Western powers. The White House acknowledged the extremist group's weapons gains recently. "We don't have a complete picture, obviously, of where every article of defense materials has gone, but certainly a fair amount of it has fallen into the hands of Taliban," White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters, adding, "And obviously, we don't have a sense that they are going to readily hand it over to us at the airport," unquote. And a Pentagon official declined to say what efforts were underway to stop further weapons gains. Asked by a reporter if the U.S. was taking any sort of steps to prevent aircraft or other military equipment from falling into the hands of the Taliban, Army Major General Hank Taylor responded, "I don't have the answer to that question." Elias Youssef, deputy director of the Center for International Policy Security Assistance Monitor, said the Taliban's weapons gains deserve a scrutiny. He told The Hill, "Clearly, this is an indictment of the U.S. security cooperation enterprise broadly. It really should raise a lot of concerns about what is the wider enterprise that is going on every single day, whether that's in the West Asia region, Sub-Saharan Africa, or East Asia. The concern for all small arms is that they are durable goods and they can be transferred, sold," said Youssef, adding, "We have seen this before, where a conflict ends and the arms that stay there make their way to all parts of the world." Also seized by Taliban, The Intercept reported recently, citing information from current and former U.S. military officials, are American military biometrics devices. These handheld interagency identity detection equipment, called HIDE devices, could have biographical information on Afghans who helped U.S. forces, and it's possible the Taliban could seek help from Pakistan's spy agency to process the data. The reporting on the weapons gains came the same week as the latest assessment from the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, SIGAR, the Congress-created watchdog. If the goal was to rebuild and leave behind a country that can sustain itself and pose little threat to U.S. national security interests, the overall picture is bleak, wrote John Sopko, the head of the agency. Thank you. Among the key conclusions in the report was that the U.S. government did not understand the Afghan context and therefore failed to tailor its efforts accordingly, and that U.S. government agencies rarely conducted sufficient monitoring and evaluation to understand the impact of their efforts.
A simple question.
Is Britain confused over COVID? For 18 months, the public has been given varying instructions about the management of the coronavirus pandemic. Everything from social distancing through to wearing of masks has been the subject of government edict, as ministers relax rules only to reimpose them. This has led to general confusion about what's guidance, what's important, and what's the law.
Many question why they can't travel when they've been fully vaccinated, when this was supposed to be their way out of the restrictions on social interaction and travel. This has turned airports into ghost towns and crippled the travel industry. To make matters worse, explosive messages leaked by the British Prime Minister's former aide, Dominic Cummings, allege that Boris Johnson originally refused to take the country into lockdown because the people dying are essentially all over 80. Meanwhile, the government's track and trace app has forced hundreds of thousands of people a week into self-isolation, a pandemic that has caused many to simply delete the app rather than find themselves isolated from work, friends and family. This mass isolation has led to labour shortages, cancelled public transport and empty shelves, all due to a lack of staff.
So how does the public feel about the continuing restrictions, even for the fully vaccinated? And to what extent have the actions of individual ministers affected the behaviour of the general public? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. To what extent have the continuous rule changes, for example about social distancing, affected the level of understanding or the level of confusion amongst the public? That's what we asked the people in London. Here's what they told us.
I think I probably did very vaguely for about 2 days in March 2020. But to be honest, I don't. And I don't really watch the news much anymore because it's just very, very depressing and it doesn't make a lot of sense. And you've got to that point where it's so frustrating that, to be quite honest, I've given up.
Not massively. As far as I understood it, we were now down to the great British public's common sense.
I thought they were going to keep stuff in. But I think they've changed it now, so there's nothing, and now, but there's still places saying that they want them. So I don't know what I'm doing anymore. So, yeah,
they do change quite a lot. It's difficult to follow them sometimes, but I think most people get the hang of it. People seem to be a bit more polite when you're crossing the street or passing on the path. So.
It's now confused beyond to prepare. I think the mixed messages have been non-ending. They've stopped the daily briefings. All the devolved governments are following their own instructions, their own rules, and they have done throughout COVID. So I think it's become very confusing for people. I think most people think it's over, and I think they're behaving accordingly, and they're not really paying attention to anything, certainly anything that central government at Westminster is saying now, because of the inconsistency, the shambolic nature of the messaging, the double standards. They don't trust what Boris Johnson or central government is telling them when it comes to this virus. And they know that since the vaccines have been rolled out to 60% of the adult population that were vaccinated, they've left medical science behind and are now following a course that's driven by ideology, the ideology of the market. So they're carrying out a large scale experiment with public health, and they've now gone back to their original plan, which is herd immunity.
I think what we've got here is that people are rightly suspicious of Dominic Cummings. But you know, when thieves fall out, honest men prosper. And what we're seeing here is the two people who were thick as thieves as the beginning of this crisis are falling out. And through their dispute, you know, a lot of facts that we saw throughout the narrative of the pandemic are being confirmed. You know, it was very interesting that you know, Boris, for example, has said during the pandemic he was governed by capitalism and greed. And at the start of the pandemic, before we were starting the first wave proper, we had Dominic Cummings, who had been caught on record on Sunday Times saying essentially the government's strategy was herd immunity, protect the economy, and if a few pensioners died, so be it. And now we've got added to that Cummings himself saying that the Prime Minister was saying, let the bodies pile high.
What does the public think of the restrictions on travel? And does it make sense to force individuals to quarantine, even if they're fully vaccinated, or indeed, if they've fully recovered after having experienced COVID-19?
I think we were reflecting on this in the car when we were travelling up. The fact that we could go abroad last year, unvaccinated, and now, of course, you know, it's great to be in London for vacation, but it's not where we would have chosen to go. So, I mean, there's a massive irony in that, but I think it's ridiculous. And we're trying to find a way forward so that our daughter can go abroad to study, and it's incredibly complex. I find myself reading and rereading the guidelines on, you know, over and over again, and they do seem to shift all the time.
I do understand that previously there's been probably a few problems with travel that have allowed the things like the Delta variant, so people will be a bit cautious, and I do understand that. And I do understand that in other countries who have had less vaccinations, it's not a great idea to knowingly perhaps transport COVID to those countries or make it worse. So to be quite honest, I don't see anything wrong with us avoiding traveling for a little. I'm a big traveler. I travel to Asia 2 or 3 times a year if I can, and I haven't been able to do it, but you just accept that, don't you? For a few years, we've got to be a bit more patient, I think.
Yeah, I'm fine with having limitations on it, because it's not just about us, it's about the countries we could take it to. And just because I'm vaccinated and like you, I've had it, doesn't mean I can't take it somewhere else. So I'm fine with there being some limitations. I actually felt they were quite slow to limit people going backwards and forwards to places like India in the first place.
I understand the travel restrictions. Even if you're fully vaccinated, I still think there should be some travel restrictions, because I think you can still get it, I think, or you can pass it on. But I don't sort of understand the travel restrictions and when something becomes where you can't go, you can go. That's basically my understanding of it.
Depends. I don't think we'd like people bringing a different variant in, perhaps, so I can see some sort of strict point there. But it is a difficult one, definitely, to... I don't know what's right. Nobody knows what's right. That's the problem, I think.
This is the worst possible government that's landed on the lap of the British public at the most critical time in the midst of this pandemic, the greatest public health crisis in 100 years. And we have a government of rogues. And it was Edward R. Murrow who said quite presciently that a nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves. And so this is an indictment of the British public that they voted in this man, this charlatan, Boris Johnson, and this government of opportunists and careerists. They have made a virtue of corruption. They've been handing out huge contracts to their friends in the private sector using COVID as a pretext. They've taken advantage of the shock therapy. Now, Naomi Klein famously wrote that book, which I would encourage all your viewers to read, that these people take advantage of shocks in society in order to push through otherwise rebarbative policies and get away with corruption. And so, you know, criminal negligence is the stamp of this government. And I think when social historians look back on this period in 50 years or so, they will look back with a degree of astonishment that this government was allowed to, first of all, come to power, but to remain in power, regardless of all the missteps over COVID. Boris Johnson's appalling ratings are still high. relative to his opponent, Keir Starmer. That's an indictment of the British public. It's also a very withering indictment towards Keir Starmer, the current leader of the Labour Party.
I think the answer to that's pretty obvious, isn't it? the question answered itself. We've had numerous examples of hypocrisy, and it hasn't stopped, has it? It's still ongoing.
That's the one thing that I've really hated, because just before all the restrictions finished, I got pinged and I had to self-isolate. And I was wanted to go to work because I need the money. And then when I saw that Boris Johnson wasn't going to do it, I was livid. And that's what really flipped me from, because I voted Conservative last time. That's what really flipped me. I'm not sure what I'm not voting him next time, though. So
I don't think anyone would really believe that they are practicing what they preach. It's extremely transparent that they feel that the rules are not for them. One rule for them and another rule for us.
It's a difficult job. I wouldn't want it. Some things good, some things bad. I don't like the fact that they're giving perhaps government contracts away in a way they shouldn't do, but I wouldn't like his job. I think he's done fairly well in some respects and not in the others, definitely.
And I think it's been a slippery slope ever since Dominic Cummings and Barnard Castle. And I just think, certainly amongst the people I frequent with, I think there's little or no trust in them being the role models and them modelling what we should do as people. It absolutely feels like one rule for them and one rule for us. Absolutely.
There are different and contradictory things to say here. There's no question that the people are deeply suspicious of the early lifting of restrictions. And if you look around, most people are still wearing masks when I go outside. You know, they haven't simply abandoned them. But I do have to say, if you look at the one thing that was done well in this country, it was the rollout of the vaccine program. We have a lot of vaccine skepticism because of the levels of mistrust of the government, and a lot of people who really should take the vaccine to protect themselves from COVID, which is a serious disease, really is a serious disease. There's no question about that. They've not taken it, and it's those people now who are falling sick. What is true is that children, certainly people under 20, are at very low risk from COVID, even if they get it, and it's principally amongst those groups, the unvaccinated and the young, who are getting COVID now. So we are seeing very large numbers. Certainly independent sages are extremely worried about those numbers and that there may be a new variant, as you say. But actually, the vaccine is effective. The vaccine program has proven to be effective, and we have essentially protected the oldest and most vulnerable. So I'm not, Saeed, an advocate of indefinite extension of lockdowns and curtailment of individual liberties. Of course, that needs to be balanced with a general good. I think a persuasive, inclusive policy of trying to persuade people who are vulnerable to be vaccinated would be the best thing. We have huge numbers of alienated and impoverished people who are refusing to protect themselves because they mistrust the government. I think this is the biggest issue at the centre of this question.
Let's look at the facts. By the end of July 2021, according to government statistics, 129,500 COVID-19 deaths had been recorded in the UK, with a total of 5.8 million identified cases of the disease recorded in the same time. Meanwhile, the pandemic continues. In the week up to the 21st of July 2021, 689,313 people had been forced to self-isolate in a single week, causing massive labour shortages nationwide.
How does the public feel about WhatsApp messages leaked by Dominic Cummings that appear to show Prime Minister Boris Johnson demonstrating little regard for over 80-year-olds who have died or risk dying from COVID-19?
That's what he says. I don't know whether we can trust him because he done one thing and they're all the same. They say one thing and do another. So it's, what to believe, I don't know. That's the trouble.
I think we only know about 3% of really what's going on with these leaks. I think there's a Machiavellian enterprise that one day will all unravel. But to be quite honest, I wouldn't be surprised if Boris Johnson is leaking things about himself in a very, very complex way. I think it's a tip of the iceberg, and I think you just have to ignore really what is being said in this. It's a game being played out by a few politicians for their own benefits, not for ours.
I don't know what he believes. I don't know what Cummings believes. But the fact that they're willing to dish the dirt on each other just shows you the kind of characters we're dealing with, doesn't it?
I'm not surprised. And even from the joke memes, you know, that they seem to just get the tone spot on. It would seem that there's a private face to what the government says, which is pretty shambolic. And there's the face that amongst themselves. And certainly I feel that they treat us with little contempt, really.
I'm not surprised, but then again, I don't really trust what comes out of his mouth either, so I don't trust anything at the moment, so...
They're in a difficult situation. It's difficult to read the nation at present. Working people have absolutely fallen out of love with the Labour Party, and therefore there is no national-scale opposition. And while some people are struggling to build one, I myself have been a part of that. I think George Galloway has been a part of that. The election result at Batley and Spen was very significant. There's not been a left candidate who's come and received 20, 25% of the vote in any election for 100 years. So Labour have held this monopoly as the second British political party. They are just being disintegrated. And as a result, people are simply voting for the only party which is there, in their opinion, in most elections, which is the Tory party. So they're almost indemnified against their own failure, you know, by the current political dynamic. It's for the working people to create a force that can change that. At the moment, there's little sign of it, of course. And there was the Aylesbury by-election in which the Tories were defeated by the Liberal Democrats. There's a deep malaise and a deep discontent, essentially, with worsening standard of living, which has been happening really since the 2009 crash and has only been made more profound and will keep on getting worse over the unfolding years. But until there's a political expression for that that can challenge the Tories electorally, they're kind of sitting back and wondering how they're getting away with it at this point.
I'm not surprised in the slightest. It doesn't come to me as a shock. I don't think it'll come to anyone with any scintilla of political consciousness or who understands what Boris Johnson is and who he is and how he operates and how he thinks. This is an eaten, educated fanatic, and he has scant regard for public health. We know that he was resistant to the idea of a second lockdown in winter. He said, let the bodies pile high. This is coming from Dominic Cummings, who is then his chief advisor. The man's a disgrace. He has a stone in his chest where his heart should be, and he's shown that throughout this pandemic.
Does the public have any idea when the pandemic restrictions will finally be lifted? Or do people fear that these limitations on civil liberties, including vaccine passports and travel restrictions, will be in place forever?
I think it will change, definitely. It's just given it time. As long as no more variants come in or another strain of something comes in, I think you can't control us forever that way. It's no good for the economy. It won't do any good for anyone, so you can't stay in it forever, definitely not.
Eventually, I think this is going to be around in some form or another, with some kind of restrictions for maybe 4 or 5 years. Who can see beyond that? I'm not a scientist. I really don't know.
I think we'll be living with it for a long time. There does seem to come a point where you have to jump one way or the other, I think. But certainly it seems like we are reaching a form of, almost by accident, a form of herd immunity. But I think certainly the people, I think people wish to still wear the mask and still keep their distance. So I think it'll almost be pushed by the public more than central government. I think that's certainly the way it feels. Certainly where I live in Bristol, it's the compliance is still really, really strong. Even though you go into a shop, people say you don't have to wear a mask, but you know, people do.
I hope so. But part of me deep down thinks no, but can but hope.
Not forever, but for a long, long time. I reckon another 3 years at least before it's perhaps to what it was in 2019, 2020. I think we're just, like I said before, we've got to hold our breath and be patient, because it's going to take a long time to work its way out, I think.
I understand the argument, and certainly if you look at a lot of people, independent sage, they will have a similar point of view. I think that we're not going to see hugely increasing rates of vaccination. Now we're getting to the point where GPs are returning vaccine to the vaccine program, because actually the people they're offering it to at this stage are the ones who do not want to have it. So what we've now reached is probably we're getting close to the limits of the people who will voluntarily accept vaccination. The question is whether we're going to coerce them or persuade them. I would advocate persuasion. It seems as if our government are going down the lines of coercion, which will create further problems and compound the inequalities. In terms of the world, this is far from over. Okay, if we look at Indonesia, they've only vaccinated perhaps 5% of their population. The only country throughout this pandemic, well, one of the few countries, there are others, who managed it really well, are China, who had an initially very stringent lockdown in the areas affected, targeted response, graded response across their community, used technology, mobilized their resources to deal with it, and through public health measures prior to any vaccination were able to achieve zero COVID. I have total sympathy with the people from independent stage experts who essentially think we should achieve independent COVID. But we have to recognize that within our socio-political system and with a government and an economy that are totally unwilling to, you know, make the changes to achieve that. Whilst we can criticize and say we shouldn't have started from here, we are where we are. And actually the only effective tool we've had is vaccination. Vaccination has worked for us. What we really need to do is vaccinate the rest of the people. Yes, there can be further variants. Actually, we've seen that vaccines are effective against all the variants that we've seen so far. So this is something to monitor, but not something to radically change our perspective, in my opinion. But the other countries, yes, we need urgently to allow them to deal with it. They haven't got social systems that have allowed them to achieve zero COVID. They're getting, you know, massive waves that we've seen in Indonesia, as we've seen in India.
Right.
And you know, that is a system, that is the system of global inequality that is also inherent to our world today that we're dealing with rather than a medical problem.
Well, I'm following the medical science. I'm not following Boris Johnson. It was Boris Johnson or his government that was telling me that I had to do these certain things in order to manage COVID, then I would be asking serious and cynical questions. But I think we have a problem, that we have a crisis of media information, and we have a crisis when it comes to the growing traction of conspiracy theory, because we now have some of these conspiracy theory cranks, and they are cranks, they're anti-public health cranks, who are now turning their guns on the NHS. There was a demonstration in London just last weekend where some of the speakers were comparing NHS doctors and nurses to Nazi doctors and nurses that were working in concentration camps in the Second World War. You could not believe it. This is where we are now. This is a debased culture, and the conversation around COVID has been absolutely horrific on the fringes, but it has a growing traction with otherwise intelligent people now believing that this is some sort of encroaching fascism. Wearing a mask is an unacceptable imposition, and social distancing is the start of some kind of lurid conspiracy in order to keep us under control in some kind of open prison with the World Economic Forum and Bill Gates and you name it. So there have been a lot of casualties of COVID, those who died of the disease, those who suffered long COVID, but there's also been casualties of those who suffered a collapse in intelligence and in rationality.
There is increasing anger and frustration about the limits on international travel, with people losing confidence in their ability to understand what they're allowed to do. They fear that if they do book something, they'll end up high and dry abroad or facing quarantine at home. With the additional revelations of messages by Dominic Cummings about his former boss, the Prime Minister, which seem to suggest Boris Johnson was not very worried about elderly COVID-19 deaths, many question how seriously the government is taking the impact of the disease on the elderly and infirm.
There is a risk that the government will lose the cooperation of the British public through inconsistency, confusion, and the fact that ministers themselves have set a bad example through their own behaviour. For Britain and for the world, the COVID-19 pandemic is far from over, but it's quite possible that the British government is losing the faith and authority over the British public to handle this serious situation.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
America's giant intelligence failure in Afghanistan will frighten its friends and comfort its rivals, says Peter Osborne Ryder in an article published under the heading, U.S. Humiliation in Afghanistan Could Be a Turning Point in World History. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. It's just over three decades since the Soviet Union was driven out of Afghanistan in a moment of epic national humiliation. 32 years on, and recently the United States has suffered the identical fate. In each case, the same story, a global superpower defeated by a peasant army from one of the poorest countries in the world. This is a world historical moment. It raises two momentous questions. The first concerns Afghanistan itself. Will the nation subside into civil war as happened after the collapse of Soviet rule? The second concerns the United States. Will victory for the Taliban mark the end for the United States global power? There are reasons to suppose that the answer is yes. Collapse is possible, but there are reasons to hope not. First, Afghanistan has endured more than 40 years of conflict since the Soviet invasion of 1979. Most people yearn for a quiet life, and Afghans have more reason to be tired of war than most. Secondly, the Taliban that seized power in Kabul in mid-1990s and committed such terrible atrocities was primitive, sectarian, bigoted, shaped by poverty and suffering. By contrast, many Taliban leaders are more sophisticated, some with university degrees and far less sectarian. This helps explain why their consistent message since winning power recently has been to reach out to all sides. There are also deep concerns about women's rights, fully justified due to the Taliban's long history of misogyny. Here, too, the Taliban have been making welcome noises about girls' education. Many do not believe them, and we should all be skeptical. History can give us some insight. The Taliban have been ruling large swathes of rural Afghanistan for several years, so we know what the rule looks like. According to an impressive study, Life Under the Taliban Shadow Government, written by Ashley Jackson and financed by Denmark, the Taliban have sought to correct many of the flaws and shortcomings that undermined the rule in 1990s. The ban on women and girls attending school has been removed, though Most Taliban officials insist no ban existed in the first place, and the Taliban have publicly stated that all women should have access to education. In practice, the report frankly admits this research could not identify a single girl's secondary school open in an area of heavily Taliban influence or control. However, Jackson points out that this is a general problem in rural Afghanistan and not restricted to Taliban areas. There are many Taliban factions, and the leadership will find it hard to control them all. A return to the bloodshed of 1990s is possible, but we hope and believe that the signs are reasonably good. And now we turn to the future of the United States Empire. Ever since 1945, some would argue before, the United States has been the dominant global power. The recent humiliation of the U.S. places a giant question mark over that status and may come to be seen as a turning point in world history. There are many reasons for thinking this. The failure of the U.S. to foresee how quickly the Taliban would enter Kabul demonstrates yet again the Americans' congenital inability to understand the country it has occupied for 20 years. This giant intelligence failure will frighten its friends and comfort its rivals. But U.S. President Joe Biden knows the country he leads has lost the taste for foreign entanglement and war. He may be mocked in foreign capitals and inside the State Department. But what a message these events send to U.S. allies. Former U.S. President Donald Trump unkindly told Saudi King Salman he wouldn't last 2 weeks without U.S. support. The events of the last week have shown that the U.S. will cheerfully ditch its allies. The House of Saud will not be the only regime looking to forge a new set of relationships as the United States backs away. Europe, too, will need to rethink its security architecture. Henry Kissinger once remarked that it may be dangerous to be America's enemy, but to be America's friend is fatal. That remark has never seemed as relevant as today.
Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, an ambitious $11 billion project that would transport natural gas from Russia directly to Germany by bypassing Ukraine. The project will double the existing Nord Stream pipeline running from Russia to Europe across the Baltic Sea and is a sustainable way to ensure European energy security. The Nord Stream 2 project is close to completion, yet it has for long caused tensions between Moscow and Washington. The United States sees the project as a potential threat, believing that it will increase Europe's dependence on Russian gas exports and isolate Ukraine. As a matter of fact, by bypassing Ukraine, Russia and the European Union could save the transit fees that make up to 3% of Ukraine's GDP. In addition, Washington worries that Moscow's success in transferring natural gas to Europe would undermine the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions in place against the country since 2014 due to the conflict in Ukraine. On Friday, Washington slapped new sanctions on a ship and two entities involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. At the same time, U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order allowing for sanctions to be imposed on certain Russian officials. Although this deepens the rift between the U.S. and Russia, it is unlikely to have much impact on the nearly completed energy project. The U.S. and Germany had struck an agreement when it came to Nord Stream 2. The Biden administration waived sanctions on the company overseeing the construction of the pipeline and its chief operating officer, yet it goes ahead with sanctioning Russian officials. It appears that the U.S. is still after sabotaging this project.
But basically, they're trying to look tough even though they are kind of surrendering, because it's clear that the Nord Stream will take place. Who is very much kind of stand to lose as a result of that is Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine utilizing the oil pipeline, more or less 20% of their income depends on that. So Ukraine is going to lose money, and that's what the United States' interest is. They ask Germany to help. They don't want to pay themselves, so they push Germany to help Ukraine. But so that's the bottom line. But, you know, so they can sanction the Russians, but they more or less will have to agree with the Nord Stream to go on.
Britain and the U.S. both targeted seven Russians with sanctions and also issued a joint statement warning Russia over chemical weapons. The targeted Russian individuals are described as Russian security officials allegedly involved in a nerve attack on Navalny last year. This is while Moscow has denied any involvement in the incident. Washington separately imposed sanctions on another two men and four Russian institutes it said were involved in chemical weapons research or what it described as an assassination attempt against Navalny. Navalny was poisoned using a nerve agent. He was flown to Germany for medical treatment after falling ill in Siberia on August 20th last year. Though he survived, he was arrested in January when he returned to Russia. The U.S. has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the latest round of sanctions over Nord Stream 2 and the Navalny case, Russian Foreign Ministry condemned the measures as unilateral and illegitimate, vowing that Moscow's response to sanctions will be tough and appropriate.
The developments in Afghanistan have been making headlines for the past few days, following the chaos that ensued the abrupt U.S. troops withdrawal from the country. The Taliban's meteoric rise to power and pandemonium at the Kabul airport prompted criticisms against how the U.S. pulled out its troops and also the outcome of the 20-year war on Afghanistan. Western politicians were among those expressing regret over incidents in Afghanistan, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying it appeared that all the troops killed in the war had died in vain. But that's not the only bitter legacy of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. Russia's Security Council Secretary Nikolai Petrushev has said that Washington turned the Central Asian country into a global illicit drug laboratory in the past 20 years. In an interview, the Russian security chief noted that the production of opiates in Afghanistan have increased over 40-fold during the past two decades.
Well, obviously, a lot of this was being produced during the time that the United States and the NATO forces were active in Afghanistan. And there was really never a concerted effort. There were attempts every now and then, you know, to do destroy fields and to, you know, persuade the farmers to produce, you know, corn or wheat or something like that. But it was not very successful, and it was never really a concerted effort on the part of the authorities to do that.
The Russian official added that the war crippled Afghanistan's economy, throwing it back decades. The United States has been training Afghan government forces for the past 20 years. Out of 300,000 Afghan troops, 22,000 have been commandos, that Washington says have received special training. Despite that, the Taliban managed to sweep through the nation in a matter of days and seize the capital, Kabul, faster than anybody had anticipated. The rapid rate at which Afghan cities fell to the militant group also stunned Pentagon officials.
They had the training, the size, the capability to defend their country. This comes down to an issue of will and leadership. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else, see a collapse of an army that size in 11 days.
According to Russia's security chief, Nikolai Petrushev, the West was never able to train the army, police, and security services of Afghanistan, as the number of attacks in Afghanistan have increased significantly after foreign forces were deployed to the country.
The Taliban, during the course of the time the United States was so-called in charge in Afghanistan, and really they controlled only a small part of the country. They were never in control of the entire country. Much of this, much of the Taliban influence was still making itself felt in various parts, in especially in the region, some of the mountainous regions that often were inaccessible to large-scale military intervention. And the fact that that was an ongoing fight in which the Taliban were pitted against the official Afghani forces, then it seems reasonable that these would increase to the extent that they still felt themselves at war with a foreign power.
Petrushev added that the reported 40,000 civilian deaths since 2001 in Afghanistan has been understated, and that the figure doesn't include tens of thousands of Afghan troops that have been killed over the years. The Russian security official concluded that the staggering number of deaths is a result of the U.S. interference in the domestic affairs of other countries.
A shocking United Nations climate report has sounded a serious warning about global warming, saying that humans are explicitly to blame for irreversible climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described the report as a code red for humanity and urged an end to the use of coal and fossil fuels. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has concluded that the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal of the Paris Agreement would likely be breached by 2030, a decade sooner than it projected just 3 years ago. Countries should also end all new fossil fuel exploration and production and shift fossil fuel subsidies into renewable energy. The alarm bells are deafening, and the evidence is irrefutable. Greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel burning and deforestation are choking our planet and putting billions of people at immediate risk. He also added that the report makes clear that there is no time for delay and no room for excuses. The IPCC report came just 3 months before a major UN climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland, where nations will be under pressure to pledge vigorous climate action and significant financing. The UN climate report draws on more than 14,000 scientific studies and offers the most comprehensive and detailed portrait yet of how climate change is altering the natural world and what could still lie ahead.
This is like a big rock rolling downhill. You can't just say, oh my goodness, there's a big rock and stop it. It is a process that starts and keeps going, and it is not possible to stop it. We can deflect it, and we're not even doing a good job of that, but there are things we could do.
Almost every nation on Earth signed up to the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. This pact aims to keep the rise in global temperatures well below 2 degrees Celsius this century and to pursue efforts to keep it under 1.5 degrees Celsius. This new report says that under all the emission scenarios considered by the scientists, both targets will be broken this century unless huge cuts in carbon take place. The authors believe that 1.5 degrees Celsius will be reached by 2040 in all scenarios. If emissions aren't slashed in the next few years, this will happen even earlier. Scientists further warn that warming of more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average could trigger runaway climate change.
One of the things that could happen that is in the fat chance list, but it could, is that all the big corporations could say, we are on a war footing now against climate change. Everyone needs to cut their consumption of everything, and we are going to cut our production because we need to do that or we will not have a planet to live on.
With catastrophic impacts, such as heat so intense that crops fail or people die just from being outdoors. According to the Carbon Majors report, only 100 companies have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since 1988. ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Chevron are identified as among the highest emitting investor-owned companies since 1988.
That we should tell the companies, you can't do this. Not only should we prosecute, we should chop them off at the ankles, tell them they can't keep using resources and they can't keep going on with what they're doing. We will not allow them to keep producing and using resources and killing the planet.
It is expected that water problems like droughts, with its accompanying wildfires and flooding, are likely to become much worse around the world as climate breakdown takes hold. The effects will be felt across the globe, from the US, where drought is an increasing problem in the west and south, to India, where the monsoon may become more variable. Sub-Saharan Africa is also likely to experience increased drought in many areas, while flooding and drought will hit China and Europe.
Lebanon seems to be on the brink of an abyss as it grapples with a prolonged double crisis. Lebanon has been plagued by a political vacuum as politicians fail to agree on a government, while a devastating economic meltdown has become an existential threat. The situation has been widely described as the worst in Lebanon's history, with some warning that time is running out fast for those who wish to save the country. Lebanon has been without a government for a year now. The last government resigned in August 2020, days after a massive chemical blast destroyed much of the port of Beirut. The financial crisis has seen the Lebanese pound sink by more than 90% and pushed more than half of the population into poverty. The Lebanese Central Bank recently scrapped a fuel subsidy due to lack of funds. Lebanon is right now suffering from a painful fuel shortage that has caused long lines at petrol stations and worsened blackouts. Last week, over 24 people were killed when a fuel tanker exploded as people scrambled to fill gasoline in plastic containers. There have been warnings that the fuel crisis may soon force hospitals, bakeries, and other essential facilities to shut down. The grave situation has become a serious threat to the nation. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has begun acting in a bid to resolve the crisis. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has warned against any effort to block the transfer of Iranian fuel to Lebanon. Nasrallah has warned Israel and the U.S. to stay away from ships carrying the much-needed fuel for Lebanon. The Hezbollah chief says the tankers coming to Lebanon from Iran are Lebanese territory. The resistance movement has been a key player in Lebanese politics for many years and has gained popularity for its stance against Israel. The movement is very much despised by the West, especially the U.S., which is the closest ally of Israel. Western countries have imposed sanctions on Lebanon in a bid to limit Hezbollah's influence. The sanctions have played a major role in triggering the current financial meltdown. The resistance movement's ongoing effort to ease economic hardship in Lebanon will probably improve the situation to some extent. but observers believe any effective solution for the crisis needs cooperation by all Lebanese political parties. This week, Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati expressed optimism that a government could soon be formed. But on Thursday, Aoun said certain parties are blocking the formation of a new cabinet to push the country into chaos. Lebanon seems to need a competent government more than anything else at this point. Any further delay in forming a new government could have devastating consequences.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's testament. The father of the Islamic Revolution emphasized the safeguarding of the revolution and the Islamic Republic system is the greatest obligatory act. In today's program, we're going to touch upon his concerns about the enemy's conspiracies to disappoint the people from Islam and undermine their unity. Please stay with us. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to say that among the conspiracies of the enemies